And as you said, forestsoverprofits.org, if you have a computer or a smartphone, which most people do, you can check it out there. Or you can just go to my program page at kbo.fm, the Wednesday Talk Radio. It's titled Forests and Climate Over Profits. And you can, while you're there, you can also click on the donate button on the upper right-hand corner and help us out during our fall membership drive, which is ending in just a few days. Please do that. And I guess we're out of time. Thank you, Alex.
Thanks, Paul.
Thank you, Brenna.
Thanks, Paul. Good to talk to you.
Yeah, you too. And that's it for the show. Thanks for supporting KBOO, everybody. Bye-bye.
Bye.
When the good rains finally came, we stood out under cover. We watched the dry earth drink it up, just like a long-lost lover. We opened up our senses to let it in. Felt so good to feel that way again. And if you love the water,
you're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. The time is 9 a.m.
You are listening to KBOO Portland. KBOO Community Radio's annual meeting and board election will take place on Saturday, September 21st at 1 p.m. at the Show Bar in Southeast Portland. The meeting will include a state of the station presented by KBOO's Board of Directors, as well as opportunities for members to meet the candidates running in the board election. Final votes will be cast and the results of the election will be announced at the end of the meeting. Again, that's KBOO Community Radio's annual meeting and board election on Saturday, September 21st at 1 p.m. at the Show Bar, 1300 Southeast Stark Street in Portland. Ballots and more information can be found at kboo.fm/board24.
Rise and shine, because it's time to wake up the neighborhood here at KBOO. When you help support KBOO now between September 21st, your donation will be matched dollar for dollar up to $11,000. Just go to kboo.fm/give and become a member of grassroots community radio that you've grown to.
KBOO.
Welcome to Negotiating Dramatic Events with Grace Growing Medicine Reed, the show that explores our experiences, our strengths, hopes, and fears as we strive to meet the needs of others as well as our own. And now, Grace Growing Medicine Reed.
Hi, this is Grace Eagle Reed, and I am my guest today on KBOO is Rachel Cheeseman. We've had Rachel on before. We did a talk about Solboom, but today we're going to be talking about the disparity between rich and poor. And how we Rachel has some really great ideas on how to at least become informed as to what we can all do to start bringing equality to between the rich, super rich, and the super poor, and so on, which is really the subject matter on all issues, food and clothing and housing and so on. I also want to remind people, I'm just going to do this right up front. This is our drive for bringing money into the KBOO station. So if you're enjoying this show and if you're enjoying KBOO, please go to kboo.fm, 90.7 FM, and donate to keep this radio station alive and well. Okay, Rachel, go for it.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me back, Grace. So it was the first show that I did with you was on the care economy, so to speak. And just talking about how social services tend to be working on such shoestring budget, despite the fact that their mission work is in increasingly high demand. And so we're at this spot where more people are hungry, but food banks have less money to work with. Social workers have higher caseloads, but the grants that they rely on are getting cut down. And then we talked about Soul Boon, which I was thrilled to talk about because that book by Rainn Wilson was fantastic. But when you asked me to do a third show, I kind of zoomed back to that first one where we were talking about the care economy and how that really highlighted for me the problem with the capital E economy and the way we conceive of a healthy economy. And I have been reading a couple of books lately about this idea of degrowth, which is not brand new, but it has entered progressive circles in a new way since the COVID pandemic. So two of the books that I read were actually quite recent. One is Slow Down, and I believe its subtitle is A Degrowth Manifesto by Kohei Saito. And that was recently translated from Japanese. And then the other book, I'll need to pull up the actual title, but it was translated. It's kind of a collection of papers from some European scholars that are in this move on the left in Europe to reconceive of what we consider a healthy economy, because we've lived under this paradigm where a healthy economy has been understood to be a growing economy. And one of the points that Kohei Saito lays out in his book really early on is the idea that a growing economy is pretty much always a function of people without means having their quality of life eroded, so the people at the very top of the economic structure can live more luxuriously, travel more, have more houses, and their consumption is really underwritten, and then the losses are experienced by those who have less wealth, and then in particular when you kind of scale this up globally to the global south. And how it's the expansion mindset that we will sort of consume more at the wealthiest levels and figure out the finite nature of the planet and its resources down the road is really just kind of increasing our pleasure by outsourcing our pain to other people. And as an American, that hit pretty hard. And then the last book that I read on this topic was called The Day the World Stops Shopping. I don't remember the author's name off the top of my head, but that was really good too. And that book kind of plays out the thought experiment of what if we in the global north, maybe we are not the mega wealthy in America, but we're middle class Americans that exist in the top 20% of wealth globally. What if we didn't stop shopping entirely, but mostly reduced our consumption of these high replenishment superfluous goods. So we bought a few less garments every year. We ate a little bit less meat every year. And how would that sort of ripple outward? And so altogether, those three books were really interesting, and I've been thinking about them a lot. And given that part of what we talked about in that first show was we don't invest enough in the care economy, right? And how do we invest more in the care economy? What does the world look like when we do that? And then these books are all kind of on the topic of what if we invested less in these sectors of consumption where overconsumption is really driving a planetary crisis and exacerbating wealth inequality across the globe. And so it seems like it's a hot topic. A lot of really smart people are talking about it, and I'm just thrilled to be reading their books.
Well, and that's actually the political arena right now, is the super wealthy and our first woman and then mixed race president of the United States, hopefully, will change the history of this country, and it's about time, right? But
So this is what the whole topic is about, is shifting what you're talking about and shifting into that middle class, which balances and brings everything to a, sort of an equalization. And it's okay to be wealthy and have a lot of money, and it's okay to have somebody with a little cabin somewhere, but it's not okay to have people living on the street in tents, homeless and hungry, and so on. So we've definitely got to change something in this country. And this is part of why I love talking to you, scholar. You're a scholar.
Yeah, a casual scholar.
You're a scholar for sure. And I really appreciate talking to you about this. So let's go ahead and elaborate on more of what you propose that we do and what can be done on a practical level from all of us, from us who are concerned about this.
Yeah, so really quick, I just want to circle back. There were two books that I mentioned. So Slow Down by Kohei Saito. I had the title and the author together for that one. And then the other ones that I've been reading are called The Future is Degrowth. That's the one that is a translation of a couple of working papers that were put together by European scholars. Their names are Aaron... I'm going to not say this right, and I apologize in advance. Aaron Van Sintian, Andrea Vetter, and Matthias Schmelzer. And then The Day the World Stopped Shopping is by an American author, J.B. McKinnon. And so the one that's as far as like practically sort of what does it look like day to day if we start living a little bit differently? I think McKinnon's book, it can be really illustrative because that's written from the perspective of somebody who's in this kind of problematic 20%, where it's like, you know, they're getting by in America. They are not like, they are not flying on a private jet. They are not owning multiple houses in, you know, one in Sedona, one in Hawaii, and then their main home in LA. You know, they're not living, they're not, you know, concurrently operating multiple properties in places where it's very resource intensive to live and where there's intense competition for the resources that exist. They're a writer, presumably in New York, you know, and they're doing okay. But, you know, as a resident of the global North and of the United States in particular, our lifestyles are being underwritten all the time by the global South, right? Everything from the, you know, the batteries in our cell phones to the batteries in our laptops to the paper products we use and the clothing that we wear. And it's interesting because I think that not books like that, they can sound very out of touch and very preachy. And one of the things that the author does kind of right up front is say, and, you know, it doesn't require extreme austerity for us to kind of tip things in a better direction, right? So what they propose is sort of a 25% reduction of what they call kind of recreational consumption, right? So going shopping for fun and going on, you know, like vacations that kind of revolve around shopping. And I do think that that's one of the ways in which the capitalists have kind of broken our concept of leisure and enjoyment is by making it all about consumption. You know, I am not knocking Disney World. If folks want to go there, they should. But theme parks at the end of the day are a place that you pay to go in and shop, and then the rides are sort of there. And of course, it's all about instilling a certain level of loyalty with different franchises so we continue to patronize and want to go back to them for our entire lives. So this 25% reduction in kind of recreational shopping that this author proposes, they say kind of out the gate, is going to put us back to living a lifestyle of roughly the 1970s in the United States, which was, again, not a problem-free time from a kind of colonialism and imperialism perspective, right? You know, we're not looking back on the United States with rose-colored glasses and saying, wasn't it great? Weren't we treating the planet so well in the 1970s? So much as saying that's a big reduction we can take without really compromising on our quality of life. And something that they talk about in The Future is Degrowth is the idea that something, the political forces that want us to not question the system as it is today will say, is they construct this kind of straw man, where it's like, if we start constraining our consumption in order to live a little bit more gently on the planet and to live more sustainably, then, you know, we're going to be living these incredibly austere lifestyles and having no fun and never traveling. And these authors kind of go out of their way to say, that's not what happens, right? We travel a little bit differently. Maybe we would travel a little bit more infrequently, but we still travel. It's just not luxury travel, and it's not all the time, and it's not on private jets. You know, maybe it's a little bit more train heavy, which I love trains. You will never hear me knock a train. I wish I could take trains everywhere. So the authors do a lot of kind of, pre-landscaping and tone setting to be like, don't think that when we talk about scaling back consumption, we are talking about no air conditioning, no meat ever. We're just talking about sort of bringing things in a little bit so the earth remains habitable for a while. And then the folks, especially in The Future is Degrowth, they really drop the hammer and say, we also need to be really realistic that none of this is going to make an impact if the top 1% do not really rein in their consumption, right? So the Kardashians having to give up their mansions and their private jets and all that stuff, that's going to feel like real austerity to them, you know? And I do weep for the people who really depend on their private jets. I don't. But so they do kind of a lot of things at once, which is say, like, yes, the Leviathan in the room are the people who are living these really, really grandiose lifestyles, and, you know, kind of encouraging everyone to think not just that it's normal, but that it's aspirational to be living so intensively in a way that so few can, right? Because the exclusivity of it is the point. Not everybody can have a private jet. That's what makes private jets cool. But then you take a step back and say, well, actually, private jets are inefficient and awful and really, really kind of stupid, especially when you account for the harm that comes from their existence. So yeah, that's sort of to lay that out, when I think about the ways I've tried to sort of degrow in my own life, it's been a lot of really small stuff. And I would be the first to say, none of this is gonna save the planet, right? I think we talked about like no plastic straws and bringing our own bags to the grocery store, you know, as sort of like, that's not going to do anything. And we all need to be realistic about that. But it doesn't take enough work for me to say it has to make a huge difference for me to go ahead and do it. So like I do bring my bags to the grocery store. When I want a soda from the gas station, I have a cup in my car that I use, so I'm not buying a plastic bottle every time. And I do think that we've gotten some, you know, pretty sad, but also not exactly surprising news that, much as we suspected and believed, plastics that get recycled don't actually get recycled. So I've been trying to really cut back on my single-use plastic use, and I know that's a really small thing. But it is something that, like, I am in control of and can do as a consumer. And it is, you know, 3 pieces of plastic a day that aren't going to wind up in the ocean.
Well, yeah, and, you know, we've been doing that. We've been doing those little, and it does count, because when you take you and me doing that times a million more people on the planet, you know, so it does make a difference. But, and there's also nothing wrong with being wealthy. We have to be very careful about, I mean, my thing about this is, people have a right to be wealthy if that's what they want to be. And there are a lot of wealthy people that are contributing. They have all kinds of charitable causes, and they do contribute heavily to that. So they take their money and they pour it into this. But we're not looking at nobody gets to be wealthy and have a private jet. Private jets are great, and we can't have a train that flies, so you got to have a jet to get to Europe and back if we're looking at the world. If we're talking about not just the United States, but we're talking about the world and the world's environment and so on. So my take on this is if you are wealthy and you have a private jet and you have that kind of money, then thank you for contributing to all the charities and the social justice arenas that you're contributing to, because without that, so people with money are helping quite a bit, actually.
Yeah.
They're using their money as a resource. But what we're taught, if we're talking about the 1%, I mean, that's, we know, okay, we've got the, and I don't mention names, you know, everybody knows who these people are, but they don't even pay taxes. So that's the social justice issue that really has to be addressed. And I think this is what these people are referring to, is can't have that.
Right.
And there are about 1,500 private jets. So let's make it clear that people that have a lot of money, and hopefully there are people on cable that have a lot of money, please contribute to cable. We're a very basic social justice radio show. But anyway, KVU.FM. So, and if you're contributing and if you're doing, I didn't have big money, but I had upper middle class money. And I always had things that I contributed to, St. Jude's and animal things and environmental things and stuff. So there's nothing wrong with that. But I think what we're talking about is the extremes.
Yes.
Of super wealth and people living on the cement in tents.
Right.
Yeah. And so we're talking about that. And, of course, mental health issues come into play on both sides, really. So so we know what we can do as just, you know, I'm not upper middle class now. I'm sort of middle-ish class now. And I'm very fixed income. I'm 81. People know who I am. And I only have so much money to, you know, pay my own rent and pay my own whatever. And I'm very grateful for anything that comes my way. And I'm doing very well because of the generosity of people who help me pay my rent and so on, so on, so on. So, but on that 1%, that disparity, how do we start? Are these people talking about how to equalize that? I think we're talking about equalization of extreme wealth, extreme poverty, perhaps.
Yes, and that is, there's not really, so the folks that are writing these books, McKinnon aside, right? McKinnon is playing out a thought experiment, but Saito and the authors of The Future is Degrowth, they're leftist economists. So it's hard to talk about what they propose without saying kind of the big scary terms of wealth redistribution, progressive taxation, and all that sort of stuff. But they do also want to talk about, they want to have a more aesthetic conversation about aspirational capitalism as kind of like the big bad in the room, right? And that's not any one wealthy family. That's just this broader idea that as someone is productive, or as an economy is productive, like the productivity is measured by the consumption, right? And the voracious consumption in particular. So, they, like, the GDP is such a tough indicator. I have a whole rant about the gross domestic product as a bad indicator, but I'll try to like smush it down into a small concept, which is like, the GDP, it measures consumption, right? It measures the sum total of the transactions related to goods and services, imports and exports for an economy, right? So there are lots of things that might be good for society that would result in a pretty big hit to the GDP, right? You know, we could pick an industry. Like if everybody who smokes cigarettes in the United States woke up tomorrow and said, "I'm not going to quit smoking entirely, but I'm going to cut it in half," right? I'm going to smoke less. Then, you know, that is less money that is moving around, and that results in this like reduction to the GDP, right? I was working a second job at a bar a while ago, and I did the math after a while and was like, I'm spending more money hanging out at this bar with my coworkers after I'm off shift than I'm actually making in my shift, right? Because I wasn't a server. I didn't make, you know, I made an hourly wage that was pretty low. So I ultimately decided to leave that job, and I was just like, whatever, I'll just like call it. So not only was that money from my wage not moving in the economy, so to speak, but also my spending at that bar pretty much went away with it, right? So there was this $3,000 that I wasn't making, and then this, you know, $3,500, $4,000 that I wasn't spending. And so that's like a total of $7,500 lost to the economy. And so those are really small examples of why, like, the GDP is just a very crude metric that we live in this societal moment where we kind of worship at the altar of GDP go up, right? That is how we get our rough hand from the government about whether or not the economy is doing well or doing poorly. We talk about consumer spending is up, consumer spending is down, consumer confidence is up, consumer confidence is down. And all of these are premised on the idea that when the economy is healthy, we are consuming a lot, we are spending a lot, and we feel good about it. But what I hear more and more from people my age, and especially younger, is that we are spending a lot, we do not feel good about it, and we do not feel confident about it. And some of that is that the cost of goods has outpaced our ability to pay for them. But also this kind of like persistent ego guilt all the time of like, I recognize this system I'm a part of is destroying the only planet we're ever going to live on. And like, I feel messed up every time I take a shower. I feel messed up every time I turn on the air conditioner, even though it's 90 degrees out. Yeah. And so that's where I think this idea of degrowth is finding a lot of purchase with people in kind of my ilk.
So what we're really talking about, it seems, is spiritualizing the economy.
Well, that's
a spiritual economy. So in other words, spiritual people, I consider myself spiritually fit. I'm Native American. I have another culture also in here. but I follow a red road and I follow a Buddhist road and so on. And I'm spiritually fit. I'm 81 years old, and it took me, in my 40s, I wasn't spiritually fit. And then some incredibly great force of darkness threw me into to a place where I could make a choice between darkness and light. And it threw me into the light and love space, and it saved my life. And I am spiritually fit. So as spiritually fit people, take any system. See, capitalism, this is a capitalist country, and it was founded on what the system you're talking about, which produces extreme wealth, and the hell with the extreme poor. Too bad, go get a job, you know how that goes. So capitalism doesn't care about people. It cares about money comes before people, and it's always been that way.
Yeah.
So that's what's shifting and needs to change, and it's chewing up people, it's chewing up our environment and so on. So I am very thrilled about this new shift from you're young people like you and the people coming behind you, and I'm thrilled that there's a shift in this. So we're talking about virtues and ethics and you know, compassion and all of that. So if you put ethics and compassion and virtues behind economy, then you will find a way. You know, this is my wheelhouse, is spiritualizing the economy or spiritualizing anything that we do. And when you're a spiritually fit person, you spend money in a spiritual way, not a religious way. I'm not talking about religion here, but I'm talking about spiritual. And we're all born spiritual.
Mm-hmm.
We are spiritual human beings, having a human existence, having a human experience, learning how to bring our greed and our pride and our fear and our anger and all that, which is the darkness in us, and we have darkness in us all the time, and bringing that to an adjustment to a light and love space, as I call it. So thinking about that, spiritualizing the economy, that's kind of what I'm hearing in the material that you're reading.
Yeah, and I think that comes through, you know, because the future is degrowth and slowdown by Kohei Saito. They're very economic texts, you know what I mean? Like, they are political theory texts, and that's, you know, fine. Place for theory, place for practice. I live for all of it. But I think what you're talking about as far as, I think that comes out really strongly in McKinnon's book, because so much of what they're talking about is the way that consumption becomes this kind of, like, it's not mindless, because it's something that we're doing in a kind of like social context, right? So you can't participate in a social context mindlessly. And so what McKinnon talks a lot about is kind of divorcing ourselves from the earn and spend cycle. So like the earn and spend cycle is something that we can get trapped into and locked into, either because of habits that we are not encouraged to interrogate and in fact are encouraged to never interrogate. And then also, you know, there's like prestige and power stuff that gets mixed in. You know, I think that this isn't something that applies to people at my income level, but and certainly not my industry, right? But I think that there are some folks that they feel a lot of professional pressure to live and portray a certain way. I was working at a kind of I was working in a fancy place. I'll call it a fancy place. And I just remember getting kind of teased about the way I dressed and teased about the car I drove. And at the end of the day, like, I drove a pickup truck. It was like an older pickup truck, but it was fine. It was like that. It wasn't rusting. Like, the paint was fine. And the clothes that I was wearing were also fine. They just, like, I'd had them for a while. You know what I mean? I dressed in pretty simple clothes. And that was the first time I'd really felt like actual peer pressure, right? Like, I went to college, people told me to drink, and I was like, whatever. But this was the first time I actually felt something like a social sanction for not, like, purchasing on par with my peers. And I thought it was really interesting that the first time I really felt peer pressure, it did not come from, like, a food I wouldn't eat, an alcoholic thing that I wouldn't drink, or a person that I would or would not engage with in a particular way. It was very much about, like, why aren't you wearing these kind of clothes? Why aren't you driving this kind of car? And I think that that kind of stuff happens all the time. And that's where, like, the earn and spend cycle, it's like a little bit socially enforced. And McKinnon talks about that a lot.
And so it used to be called Keeping Up with the Joneses or something like that.
Yeah, exactly.
See, when I was born into extreme poverty. And so poverty people, all they were trying to do was get to a point where at least they were upper or middle class, and they worked two jobs. My father died from just that kind of thing. He died working himself to death over trying to keep up with the Joneses. And we're taught in this country from little people on,
mm-hmm.
success is money, property, prestige, you know, that's success.
Yeah, and that's where I think, like, this idea of aspirational capitalism is, like, the thing that we really need to move past for me. And so I think that, you know, where I've really kind of been taking it to heart with these books is, you know, just thinking, like, really reimagining my idea of what participating in the economy looks like and what success looks like. And it's been really kind of nice, because I think what I've tapped into is the kind of quiet luxuries that I have. And like, they're not what any of my neighbors would call luxuries, but like, I have a full spice cabinet. I consider that a real luxury. Like, the food that I make at home is delicious, because I have access to pretty solid ingredients. And I've just been kind of recategorizing some of the things in my life as luxuries. And not only has that made me willing to give up some things, right? Like, I used to have 3 or 4 streaming services. I kind of mentally rebranded those as luxuries, because they have a pretty energy intensive footprint in their own way. I don't really, you know, care about Spotify. And so when I started thinking of my streaming services as little luxuries, it was like, well, okay, then I don't, if this is a luxury to me, I don't need 4 of them. I can just like really enjoy the 2 that I have. And you know, those were small steps, but it also makes me really enjoy watching a movie on through my library.
And this is I'm going to do my KBOO obligation here. If you just tuned in, you're tuning in to Rachel Cheesman, and we're talking about spiritualizing the economy and coming from gross capitalism, 1%ism, to the tent, the people that are homeless on the street, to something insane there in the middle, something very insane and humane. So this is KBOO.FM, and this is also our time to ask you to donate to KBOO.FM, donate to the station. And you can go to kboo.fm and find the donation button and so on. And if you enjoy KBOO and you know we're a social justice radio show, we've been at it forever and ever and ever. But we are private. Our income comes from you, the listeners. So if you're enjoying the show and all the other shows on KBOO, please go and donate. kboo.fm, 90.7 FM. Thanks. Thank you, Rachel Cheesman, for being on again. This is KBOO.FM. So we're talking about spiritualizing capitalism. Ooh, there are people, I'm sure, that are almost vomiting right now. But here's what. So I want to talk about what that means. I lived in Norway, Sweden. I lived for many years in Norway, Sweden, and Finland. And I even traveled to Lavozero, Russia, because I was working with the Sami people. I'm Native American. The Samis are the natives of those 3 countries, including Russia. And so I have a working knowledge of socialist democratic systems. Norway and Sweden, Snakka Norsk, Prata Svenska. So I worked in both countries, and Finland. Can't try to pronounce Finnish. Oh my God, it's an incredible language. But one of the things I noticed is there is no poverty in Sweden and Norway, and there's no poverty in Finland, and there is, of course, poverty in Russia. But the deal is these countries have no poverty, and so socialist democratic systems produce what we are talking about here is equalizing the super wealthy to and bringing the poverty stricken at least to a little cabin in the woods somewhere. But so we're talking about systems here, because the books are written for the world, not just for the United States, right?
That's correct, yes.
Okay, so Finland is the one country that I know of that I've been to and traveled to and worked in and so on, that is perfectly balanced, socialist, democratic, and spiritual. Norway and Sweden are not necessarily spiritual. They're materialistic, and they have no poverty. you break a, you, if you're, it's a commune system. So I had a commune number. I lived in Steinkjer, Norway, and Östersund, Sweden. And when I moved, when I lived in those two villages, and Östersund is more of a city, you get a number, a socialist number. And if I broke a fingernail and I called my socialist clinic, all the clinics are set up in the villages and in the cities. And so, so people pay about 75% high tax rates. Mm-hmm. They pay for this. But if I broke a fingernail and I called them and says, I broke a fingernail, you must come. A white sedan pulls up in front of the apartment building. They come up and they fix my fingernail. That's the system they have. Health, there is no poverty. There is no health problem. There is no problem at all with any of that. But there's also no spirituality. Mm-hmm. Finland, on the other hand, has socialist, democratic, and spiritual practice. So they're the perfect country to look at to bring in, I think, what this book and what we are talking about here. What do you think?
Tell us. Yeah. So what I think is really interesting is, so these books that I've been reading, only one of them was written by somebody who I presume was American, right? J.B. McKinnon, I presume, is an American. Most of the folks that they interview is, you know, it's American companies, it's American researchers. Every once in a while, there's a UK person. So, but in either case, that kind of like global North, either economic superpower or former imperial power. You know, Slow Down by Kohei Saito. Kohei Saito is Japanese. So one of the reasons that this book is coming to us now is because it was written in 2015 and then orchestrating the translation took some time. Same with The Future is Degrowth. I get the sense that the scholars involved with that are primarily German, so not exactly Scandinavia, but in that north central European kind of regional area where there's a little bit more of the paradigm of regulate, you know, a lot of regulations, a much more progressive taxation schedule. Definitely not saying that Germany is a, you know, social democratic nation. But definitely if you contrast the way that they're sort of regulating and managing their economy, it's vastly different from the US and definitely, you know, on the regulated capitalism side of the spectrum. And so one of the things that they do really early in The Future of Degrowth that's, I think, incredibly, that was just so helpful for me, is they kind of set up this idea that there's this sort of four schools, right? So there's the Davos set, that is kind of, you know, pro status quo, right? Like they are adhering to the ideology and the hegemony of economic growth as a good, you know, and definitely not interested in reorganizing things. So we're moving away from the imperial mode of living. And the imperial mode of living is something that Saito talks about a lot. But within the Davos set, there are the folks that want to preserve the ideology of growth, but focus on recalibrating what is growing in order to make it more sustainable, right? Saito calls these people green Keynesians. And while I think that, you know, the Green New Deal is something absolutely necessary, you know, Saito has a set aside in their book about the limits of green Keynesianism, right? Which is like, no matter how much we electrify our cars, no matter how much we renewableize our energy consumption, the returns on a more renewable energy source for the level of consumption we are trying to maintain is just not feasible, right? Like at some point we do just need to scale back our consumption. And so there's the Davos set that is kind of trying to figure out how to take the world order of today and make it something that will make tomorrow last a little bit longer. But then within the Davos set, there are the folks that don't want to change anything at all. And what they want to do is really entrench the power dynamics that exist today, right? So they really want to sell out the what they consider the lower classes, right? And that would mean people like you and me in the United States, right? If we wind up homeless, that's our fault. And if we're homeless for too long, then we'll be incarcerated and be doing, you know, I think, you know, in their worlds, we'll be laboring in the prison to further defray the costs of their luxury goods, right? And then there's also the idea that, you know, that's where this jingoism about immigration comes from, right? Because that's about making sure that the lower classes, quote unquote, of the global South do not leave the conditions that have been created by the hyper-consumption of the wealthiest in the global North, right? So the wealthiest in the global North are going to create this climate crisis, and then they are going to steadfastly refuse to allow anyone fleeing those circumstances that are created from, you know, ecological collapse to seek refuge anywhere else. And so that's kind of what the authors of The Future is Degrowth refer to as the Davos set. And then there's this kind of other group of folks that are entertaining ideas that I'm not saying they are radical, but they are more radical than what the Davos set is proposing, right? And so there are the folks that are trying to figure out how do we keep our economies productive without relying so much on green Keynesianism. And then there are the folks that are like, we just need to let go of growth entirely. Like, we need to dechain our concept of sufficiency and success from the idea of economic growth. And that is what their book is dedicated to. And so I thought that that framing was really helpful for just understanding, like, you know, the authoritarianism is a different flavor of the status quo. And that's, you know, I'm not trying to mince any words. One is objectively more harmful, you know, like we don't want to live in an authoritarian and like jingoistic country, but it would be. It would be naive to say that that's not a thread of thought that's gaining purchase at the same time as politicians talking about the Green New Deal. And I think what these authors are trying to do is say, like, we're also, there are people who are trying to take us away from the hegemony of growth and just recognize that that whole project is over, or it needs to be over. And that's where we start hearing about some of the things that would result in, you know, a move in the direction of kind of the Finnish economy, where there's, you know, much more progressive taxation, much more redistribution. And this goes back to our conversation that started this all off, you know, several months ago, really, really high levels of investment in social services relative to what we see in the United States, right? In the United States, investing in social services is like, hey, there's a tax break in it for you if you give a lot of money to your church or, you know, an organization that's doing X, Y, or Z, the food bank. But in those social democratic countries, the social services are just much more baked into the functioning of the government.
Yeah, and what's interesting is putting people before, it's interesting, this thing between people and money, human beings, and who we are in our very different levels of being born into wealth, being born into upper middle class, being born into middle class, being born into poverty. I was born into poverty. But in this country, pulling ourselves up from the bootstraps or whatever the heck that used to be, we do have that opportunity. And people that have that are poverty stricken, for instance, in my case, I'm 81, so in my case, we were told marry well. It was about the only thing a woman could do in my time. We're talking about, I was born in 1943, so I'm coming from the 40s and 50s. And the 60s really drastically changed that, and I'm so glad I was part of that. But, you know, the women didn't have, couldn't even vote at one point, but the women didn't have any chance at all to do anything except have a bunch of babies so that mm-hmm. the capitalist system could be even more capitalist. But So marrying well was one strategy, and getting an education was not a projected. My two brothers were sent to college, and I wasn't even thought of to send to college. Oh, right. She will marry. She's a female. She will marry.
Mm-hmm.
So that was part of that thing. So, and where I'm going with this is, this country, we're in that political arena right now. And I'll just say it this way. If Mr. T wins the White House again, and I just can't imagine that happening, but it's possible. And I just want, and I'm saying this as a statement of hope. Things that are not working, that are dark in nature, that are based on fear and greed and ego and all of that, are a dark force. And a dark force, we could very well, this country could go very well into another dark force.
Mm-hmm.
But that just means a dark force never stays a dark force, because a dark force is, if you look at Hindu, the yin and yang, the dark force is just as sacred as the light force. And the dark force's job is to make us so damn miserable that we have to seek light.
Mm-hmm.
The only way you can get out of darkness is to seek light. And that's the sacredness of the dark force. So I want to make that clear. But if we go into this dark force, then that means that we must bottom out. We must bottom out. This country needs to bottom out with this capitalist, greedy capitalist, inappropriate system right now. And it needs to bottom out. And if Mr. T is going to be the one that's being used to do this, then it'll bottom out, and that means that this new force will come up that we're talking about, this new way of living, this new way of thinking, this spiritualizing democratic capitalism spiritualism, you know. So there's a new system that's forming now. If our first female president wins, then we're on our way to that. So either way, this country is definitely going to change. So I really appreciate this material and these books, because why don't you give the book titles again
So the one that is I don't want to say, so it's the least theoretical, which for some people might be the least interesting. It is the most journalistic in its writing. And that is The Day the World Stops Shopping by J.B. McKinnon. And that one, again, it's a thought experiment that sort of says, like, what if we all woke up tomorrow and just decided we were not all the way done, but a little bit done? You know, we decided to buy a little bit less in the way of clothing. We decided to shop a little less, you know, and so they're going off of a 25% reduction in what they consider shopping for non-essential goods, right? So your groceries are unaffected, your home is unaffected, but things like fast fashion and that kind of stuff are kind of pulled back, right? And so that one, you know, they interview a handful of researchers. They interview like a VP at Levi's to talk about what would happen to the fashion industry if we, you know, collectively decided to shop for clothing a little less. Yeah. Go ahead, Grace.
Oh, you already said that sort of. So I'm just thinking maybe it would be good to just give the titles of the book right now.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So The Day the World Stops Shopping by J.B. McKinnon. Slow Down by Kohei Saito. That's the one that was translated by a Japanese scholar. And then The Future is Degrowth. That's the one that's by a collection. It's a collection of papers by different European scholars.
Wonderful. And so that's what I was thinking, of people could get those books. And I was told that I'm not giving information on how to reach me and my guest. And if you want to reach me, you can go to uafpsu@yahoo.com. And if you want to reach me and talk about something on the show, or ask me a question, or want to be on the show or whatever, I keep forgetting to give my email. And that's uafpsu@yahoo.com. It's my two schools where I got my master's, or my bachelor's and my master's degrees: University of Alaska Fairbanks, UAF, PSU, Portland State University, at yahoo.com. So you can reach me there if you want to. And I can always link people if they want to talk more to Rachel. I can link her to you guys. Okay, so there's that. Thank you, Rachel.
Oh, of course. We've got, I think, maybe 10, 15 minutes left. And thanks for giving me the opportunity to share the book titles again. So.
Oh, God, yeah. So when I heard about them, Rachel and I talk quite often about these things. And so what I appreciate is having guests like you on the show, because you are a scholar, you're very intelligent, and you're very deepened, and we need this, and we can't. This country will change. This world will change. This world is becoming more and more spiritual, because the younger generation, having looked back at my generation, I know when I was young and I looked back on my generation behind me, where women weren't even allowed to come out of the house without it was horrible. It's a horrible way to live. So we changed that in the 60s. And now this newer generation, including yourself, you're looking back and going, well, there's got to be more change. There's got to be something even different. So what we're really, it seems like what we are all doing worldwide, because I'm still in touch with Europe and my Sami friends and my European friends, what we're all longing for is a spiritual way to live, an environment that is clean and beautiful. So we want to do the next right thing to make this world a beautiful globe that it is. When the astronauts look at it, it's this beautiful globe. But when you get down here, it's people fighting and conflict and conflict and conflict and chaos and conflict and my way and your way, and so all of that has to go bye. Mm-hmm. And that's really what we're looking at: spiritualization of any economy, of anything that the world is doing right now. And we have a very short time to save our environment, so we're in a crisis mode on this planet, which, by the way, is good, because the darkness is we're bottoming out. So we're being forced to seek mm-hmm. the answers. I call it seek the light and love force, the answers. And this is a lot of what I feel that we're talking about here. We definitely need to shift this country into a different deal, and it's on its way. Yay, Carmela. Let's do this. It's on its way, because this country has to change.
Yes. And I do also think what we spend our tax revenue on needs to change, right? Like the projects of growth and empire need to stop, and the projects of, true systems of community care, whether that's, regional rail or, a nurse corps, Those are the things that I imagine us investing in when we stop prioritizing growth and empire and start thinking about just like how do we make the next century a good one?
Yeah, and again, having lived and worked there and paid taxes, again, Finland. Look at and there's been some news about this, but Finland is probably one of the best countries to look at on how they do that, how they live, how they are. They're the most beautiful, balanced people. They are so balanced. They're wonderful, balanced people. There's no homelessness. They have a spirituality that's because of the Sami people. They have a spirituality that works. They have a democratic system that works. They have a socialist system that works. And I would say that if you want to find out what we can do in this country to help be more like Finland, look at Finland, look what they did when they first got formed, look what they're doing, and do what you can And that may be paying, just automatically paying higher taxes, or at least donating to more to St. Jude, donating more to this, donating more to that, that will bring this economy to us. And of course, I'm always going to talk about spirituality, but bring this to a spiritual, socialist, capitalist. Oh my God, people are vomiting now. spiritual way to live and work and love in this country. May we all live in light and love in the United States of America.
Right. Yeah, and I think, you know, I think it's obviously a complex position to be in, to look out and say, how does America, you know, how do we live differently while also, you know, understanding that we're not going to change everything overnight. We're not going to snap our fingers and have all of this done tomorrow. So what do we actually do tomorrow? And I don't have any good answers for that, mostly because I think it's different for every person. The things that make sense for me to do as a single person with no children are very different than the things it makes sense for, you know, a mom of two to do. And that's also very different from, you know, like, I'm very blessed and very privileged, for sure. There are folks that they're not in a position to curb their consumption or to be, you know, degrowing their economic footprint in this social context just because they're getting through the week, you know. And I think it's really hard to have an all-encompassing conversation like this because within that tent, there are people who are in such different circumstances. So I think that's my big caveat to all of this, which is I'm not making prescriptions for all people. It's just something I've been thinking about a lot.
Yes. You have been listening to KBOO.FM, Rachel Cheeseman, and this is Negotiating Dramatic Events. And please don't forget to donate to KBOO.FM if you want this social justice station to continue. And thank you for the show. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me, Grace. It's always a pleasure. Love being on the show with you. And thanks, everyone, for listening.
You're tuned in to listener-supported community radio.